This is tape two, the morning of January the 7th, 1961. Go ahead, Mr. First.
Well, the thing we were getting at was the radical Republicans and the vindictive Ted Stevens was hell-bent for imposing a supremacy of the Negro upon the Southerners. Wasn't that right?
That's true. And was with the idea in mind that they should not let the white people in the South vote for the reason that they were naturally on the Democratic side of the viewpoint. And Thad felt that if he could prevent them from voting and prevent them from coming back into the Union as states, that the radical Republicans would continue in control. But even the Northern people didn't like it because Grant had a very small majority in his second election. And the Democrats won in 1876, but the people in control set up a commission which caused the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, who turned out to be a good man and a good president.
Well, now, just to settle this thing a little more clearly, the South was the victim of an oppressive campaign by the radical Republicans after the war, to the point where the South was forced to organize its own KKKs and Knights of the Camellias and whatever they call them to defend themselves or try to protect their political rights.
Yes, that's true, and it shouldn't have happened if they'd been treated cordially and as the victims of a loss ought to be treated. There wouldn't have been any trouble, but that wasn't done.
And
we haven't come to the point where we felt like it ought to be done, I guess.
Well, Mr. President, you're also saying at the same time that it was unfair to the recently emancipated slaves to thrust that burden on them, whatever the just cause was.
Well, of course. I think that what Andrew Johnson and Lincoln had in mind was the proper education and rehabilitation of the slaves so they could become citizens. And that wasn't the idea at all of Thad Stevens and the radical Republicans. They wanted to be sure that the South was oppressed by the people who had been slaves, and that's what brought out a great deal of the ill feeling.
A very important historic event is involved in all of this, and a situation that you assess the blame for this terrible plight that was perpetrated upon the Southerners, upon Ted Stevens and the radical Republicans. You also state that this is in a large measure due to the inability of a president, whoever was president, to make the right decision to compose the differences down there. And yet the situation had to wait until 1948 or 47, when you, as president, tried to bring about the restitutions that were due to the Negroes of the South. Having been given too much, they've been deprived of their minimum rights. And then a U.S. president came along and tried to restore. Why did it take so long?
Because people had to recover. It takes two or three generations to recover from war. You take the War of the Roses in England. It took 100 years before they finally recovered from that situation. And we were faced with the same thing between the North and the South. And I think it's mostly all over as a result of common sense and a goodwill approach. And that's all it takes to make any of these things work.
Well, what the president is saying, as I understand, Mr. President, also is that the mistaken policy followed merely accentuated the differences rather than relieved them.
Oh, that's true. And that's always true with the victors in a vicious shooting war. They always feel that they can't be too mean to the conquered. And it's too bad that is the case, but it is.
Well, may I?
And if we'd followed through on that same program, we'd have had the same situation with regard to our enemies in the First and Second World Wars, but we didn't. We profited by about what had happened in our own war between the states and in the War of the Roses in England.
Well, may I ask this then, Mr. President? You believe then that the assimilation of the Negroes as citizens and giving them equal rights, which began to develop later on, was delayed because the Negroes were thrust into an unfavorable position through the manipulation of the Republican radicals.
There's no doubt about that. There isn't any doubt about that. And the rights which the Negroes have obtained since 1898 has been through the Democrats, who always wanted to give them their civil rights and their economic rights, but who were not in favor of social equality.
Well, you, when you talk about Democrats, there's no question of what the Democrats have created, a one-party situation in the South, and they've disfranchised most of the Negroes, and to that extent, the South behaved very much.
They're not the Democrats. Those one-party people in the South are not the Democrats that make up the ideals of the Democratic Party. They are totalitarians in their own situation, and it's brought about by the operation of old Thad Stevens and the Radical Republicans. Now, you find that there are an immense number of Democrats in the South, real Democrats, who believe that equal rights, are due to the Negro race. But you'll also find there's a leftover from what did that causes some of the so-called Democrats of the South really not to be Democrats. They're still living in the period of 1870 to 1890.
Therefore, Mr. President, what you're saying is that one of the most important things not to be overlooked in American history is the leftover of Thad Stevens' policy.
That's true. You find that the great men of the South, even today, are just as anxious that equal rights be given to the Negro race in the South as are those of us who live in a little further north in the border states, we might say. But the objective is to give
every citizen of the United States
equal political rights, equal economic rights, but that has nothing to do with the social situation about which the South always talks.
But the aftermath has left that feeling over a very long period.
Well, it'll keep going on for some time to come, until another generation or two comes along, then it'll work out.
But we've had a very, very major struggle trying to decide how we're going to cope with the problem. You say that the Southern Democrats, not being Democrats, merely captives of the party, using the party label.
That's what they are, exactly.
Pursue their own ends. But here we've had a period, just to give the thing in scope again, nothing was done under several very great presidents who preceded you. Some discussion, everybody always talked about it. Now, you proceeded to put your own political destiny on the block by risking the civil rights move that you made. Then nothing again happened after you left the White House until the executive being impotent, the legislative being deadlocked and blocked by the Southern. The courts have had to come in and do the work for both of these branches of the government.
And the members of that court were appointed by Roosevelt and myself.
Well, yes, but may I point out and add to that, you're talking about the executive being strong but being unable to do that, which makes a point and raises a question, Mr. President. Many of the factors in American history do not necessarily revolve you often have to deal with a social or an economic condition that sometimes he can't overcome. Isn't that true?
Well, he can overcome it if he exercises his leadership as the chief executive. getting people in and explaining exactly what he wants to do. And most of them will agree with him when he's right. I've had that experience, and I know.
Well, Mr. President, you made a...
It takes leadership to get these things done, Bill.
That's right, but you made a very vigorous and forward step during your presidency, and yet there is left still a hard core of people in the South who are unmoved by whatever you did or why.
I don't think they're unmoved. I think they are waiting for leadership to give them an out on which they can base their program for progress, and I'm very sure that they'll do that when the time comes.
Well, now, are you taking the position now that the responsibility for leading the nation out of that morass rests with the president and not with the other two branches?
Couldn't rest with anybody else but the president of the United States. And if he has the right ideas and gives the people a chance to understand what he's trying to do, he never has any serious trouble.
You said a very significant thing about the fact that those men in the Supreme Court today who, having acted upon the default of both branches, have sought to emancipate the Negro problem still further, were appointed by President Roosevelt, a forward man, and by yourself.
That's correct.
That raises the question as to whether or not the president's powers go beyond the mere platitude in his business of saying the right things. He can also act in the case of the Supreme Court, where he can...
Not only got to believe what he's saying, he's got to act on it. And he can act on it in two or three different ways, in messages to the Congress, in conversations with the leaders of the Congress, and in the appointment of judges of the courts, supreme and other courts.
But nevertheless, Mr. President, I'm coming back. Checked by this word of that Dave used about the default of the president. There was no default of Roosevelt or of you on this thing. There was a default by the people themselves who weren't prepared for it. Wasn't that all the aftermath of this entire bad history?
Well, of course, it had that aftermath had its effects. And what the Roosevelt and myself were trying to do was to overcome those effects when I made the order that stopped segregation in the military services and in other places. It was with the intention of implementing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And then when the court came to the decision that those amendments were part of the Constitution and had been in effect all the time, and made the decision which they did, then it was necessary to enforce that decision all over the country. And an effort was made to do that, although I think the approach was in the wrong manner.
Well, then, these things don't cure themselves by themselves. They have got to be directed and hastened by a pretty firm hand at the top.
By leadership. They've got to be put into effect by leadership. And the leadership has to make it perfectly apparent that what he's trying to do is right. And when the majority of people of the United States decide that the leadership is on the right track, then you don't have any trouble.
This is the end of tape two, the morning of January 7th, 1961. This is tape number three, the morning of January 7th, 1961.
Monitor control.
President, this has apparently been all right.
Yes, good question.
Can you ask the question?
Are you on now?
I don't know what happened here.
Well, the question now looms in view of what had happened in the post-war period in the South. Whether the very same people led by Ted Stevens, who were loudest in their demands for the giving of the rights, the emancipation of the Negro, whether they didn't turn out historically to be the very people who did the greatest damage to the Negro cause.
Well, I think they did, for the simple reason that they were working for political control and not for the moral background on which they should have been working. And you find that that's been true all along the line of the political setup. When they lose the idea of the moral approach to what's right, then you have the same situation which developed after the Civil War was over. And we've had it in our own time with the treatment of labor from the time of the Grover Cleveland approach to the strikes in Chicago up until the present time. And now those situations can always be met by goodwill and common sense. And you know what common sense is? It's an approach to a situation with the idea that the other fellow has his viewpoint and that the proper thing to do is to sit down and argue that viewpoint out with him. And you've got to be in a position where you feel that he's an honest man and that he wants to go ahead on a basis of his own viewpoint and that he's willing to talk to you or he wouldn't be with you. Now, goodwill and common sense can settle most of these things if they sit down and talk them out, because I know from experience I've had that situation come up with regard to the Berlin Airlift, with regard to Greece and Turkey, with regard to the movement of troops out of Iran, and with regard to a great many other things on which I had to make decisions. Korea, for instance. All people who were in the head of the committees in the Congress were called in, and the Korean situation was discussed with them before an order was made to do what actually happened. And then, of course, after it was all over and Korea was saved, they made a political approach on the thing on a basis that was absolutely unfair when the candidate for president went over to Korea and surrendered on a basis that had been proposed to the then President of the United States for a year beforehand. Then we have what we have now in the Near East with the Laos and all the rest of these programs.
Mr. President, you might ask my asking this question. You talk a good deal like a Greek philosopher who believes that reason in the long run can prevail and will prevail in the solution of human problems.
Well, that's true if you have the executive in charge of the military affairs of the country that's willing to listen to reason. And that, because that has not happened since the Greek philosopher that's caused all these wars.
Well, of course, when you talk about reason and common sense, as they say so often, common sense is so uncommon and it's so difficult to reason with people who will not be reasoned with. But the in terms of our history again, the ups and the downs and the many, many waves of dislocation took place when something went out of kilter in the White House and something got too big for its britches in the Capitol. Now, could you cover that a little bit?
I don't know. That's a very hard question. Of course, the Congress has had its leaders who were very anxious to center the power of the operation of the government of the United States into the legislative branch. And that's all wrong. And then we've had presidents who sat back and let the Congress take their powers away from them, when that should not have happened. And we'll go into that in detail when we get to these various presidents.
Well, I just wondered, since we're at this point, because Stevens did his damage from the halls of Congress.
That's right.
And there were other men like Joe Cannon and who other people who assumed dictatorial powers from their positions on the Hill. Now, you've been on both sides of the fence, and you're in a position to comment on whether these people do frustrate the events of history and the events of the normal course of events.
It depends altogether on the leadership on both sides. It makes no difference how strong the leadership in Congress may be. If the president knows his powers and his duties, they can't do anything about it. Roosevelt proved that.
Now, Mr. President, there are other factors, too, that enter into it. I mean, they may be very very compelling economic factors, or there may be compelling factors of passion or sentiment that you try to indicate existed in the South, and it's pretty hard for any man, no matter how wise or determined or decisive, to overcome.
Well, I think that's true, Bill. But a leader who has a program that's worthwhile, as Woodrow Wilson did, can put his program over. And had it not been for the First World War and the forcing of the United States into that war, I think the Wilson administration would have been one of the greatest we ever had.
Yeah. What I would like to get at now, if I may please, is the industrial age, which we touched upon, in their relation to a series of presidents who would come into being right after Andrew Johnson and the unbridled growth of monopoly and the subjugation of labor to the point of where they were very, very badly squeezed. And we call that period the laissez-faire period, where anything went and monopoly was the rule. Now, what sort of a president did successor to Johnson make? Any kind of a president? Did he do any?
Grant? No, he didn't.
All right. Now, we covered him pretty well.
That's right.
All right. Our next man is, who should have been Blaine, should have been.
No. Our next president should have been the man from New York in 76. And he gave up the idea of being president
So we got Hayes.
Hayes.
So who was the man in New York? Tilden?
Samuel Tilden.
Tilden, that's right. He won the election.
He won the election, but decided not to contest it. And they had a background on which he was afraid. That is, all the things that had been said about him would come out and be proved.
And personal problems?
Yes. And that shouldn't have been considered at all.
Off the record, do you know what those are?
Well, no. I do know, but I'm not going to say.
All right. But they were not complimentary.
No. Background proposition on any president is going to be told if he's going to be president of the United States. Well, Hayes was sworn in. The 4th of March was on Sunday. And Grant brought him to the White House and swore him in on the evening of the 3rd. And then on the morning of the 5th, he was sworn in again. The Hayes program was not bad. He removed the soldiers from the South, as he told the Southerners he would, if they wouldn't oppose him as president. And that started a rehabilitation of the whole South. And you got to give him credit for that.
He removed the soldiers from
New
Orleans, that's right, and one other state, yeah.
All the states.
Yeah.
He called their soldiers back, and the Northerners and old Pat Stevens and his crowd called him a traitor.
Didn't I President you to say that Tilden had yielded any fuss about the election?
That's right.
Hayes made it clear that he would withdraw the soldiers from the South?
Yes. Well, no. He made that statement. The Southerners supported him. And that's what brought
it
about.
To go back to Hayes a little while, he didn't know whether he was going to be president, and nobody knew who was going to be president until March 2nd almost, wasn't it?
March 5th.
Oh, well, they waited until March the very last 5th. Moment before
That's
they
right.
knew who it was going to be.
March 5th. And he was sworn in on the morning of March 5th. And we've got his papers back here, and they're most interesting.
Well,
you've seen them.
Some of them. Do you hold that Tilden might have been a more appropriate president for those times?
Well, I don't know, but he was really elected. And if he had the ability and the nerve to do what he ought to, I think he would have made a good president. I don't know if he'd been any better than Hayes or not, but then he would have been a good president if he'd gone in with his background as governor of New York and the other things that came.
He was a man of considerable capacity, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. He was a good man.
Why was, beyond withdrawing the troops from the South, was Hayes noted for as
nothing.
President?
That's all.
That was his main contribution.
That's all. Except that I think he had a hand in the nomination of Garfield in 1880 at Chicago. You see, they had three candidates, nominated Blaine, nominated Grant, and nominated Sherman. And Garfield nominated Sherman. And one of the greatest speeches that have ever been made at a convention. And they had 33 or 34 ballots. Couldn't nominate anybody, it was tied up. And I'm informed by background that it's not available in some of those books over there that
personal research.
Hayes called the chairman of the committee in Chicago and said, why don't you nominate the man for president who nominated Sherman? He made the best speech. That was James A. Garfield. They nominated him, and then two more ballots, he was nominated for president. And he and Chester Arthur were nominated as president and vice president, elected. And then bad. I think Garfield would have made him a very good president. He was shot on Ohio Station in Washington. And then Chester Arthur became president. And he was a very fine-looking man. But the thing that I have always held against him is that he took all the furniture out of the White House and nine van loads of it and took it down to most important contributions of the White House in the past had been made by Thomas Jefferson and James Monroe. And when I was having the White House rehabilitated, I couldn't get my hands on that furniture because the speeches that I wanted were worth more than all, were worth more than Chester Arthur got for the whole work.
This is the end of take number 3, the morning of take number January the 7th, 1967.